Right now, it's time for Oh, the Humanities, breaking down humanities scholarship events and research on campus and beyond. And for that, as always, we are joined by Max Orr, who heads up Carolina Public Humanities on campus. Humanities.unc.edu is the website for more on that. Max, thanks as always for being here. How are you?
It has been an eventful day, and it's wonderful to be here. You know, Aaron, it's May 6th, and it's the only day when I come in where I'm a little bit awkward about our show and the title of our show, because you know I bring you something related to the date.
Yes, yes.
Well, on May 6th, 1937, the Hindenburg crashed into the pylon there.
Oh, the humanity.
Oh, the humanity. Yes. So, you know, it's the one day I can be like, ooh, you know, is it too soon? But it's a great name for our show. And, of course, that was the utterance of the reporter who saw that tragic accident in 1937 in New Jersey. But on a happy note, May 6th is also my father's birthday. Jim Orr, who is famous to me for being probably the most famous person I know, having helped create me.
Right.
But the reason I bring up my dad, he turns 83 today, and my dad is a lifelong jazz lover. I grew up with just hundreds of jazz records, thousands maybe even of jazz records. My dad would wear his Coltrane Lives shirt all the time, and just so many opportunities to be exposed to this great American musical form. And so I felt like I couldn't find anybody who's a jazz performer who was born. My dad plays saxophone, I should mention that. I couldn't find a famous jazz performer today, but it seemed fitting for our guest, who is Professor Stephen Anderson, professor of music at North Carolina, at University of North Carolina, and a pianist, jazz pianist and composer, and just a fantastic guy. And Stephen Anderson will be working with Brian Horton on May 22nd at Flyleaf Books for our first Flyleaf Summer Series musical event. I know I hinted that we're doing all music mm-hmm. at Flyleaf Books. And so, welcome, Stephen.
Thanks.
We're so great
Good
to have
to be
you
here. Thanks for having me.
So what we're going to be focusing on is North Carolina jazz. We're looking at the giants of North Carolina jazz, and it'll be a mixture of discussion and performance, both saxophone and piano. So what is about North Carolina and jazz? I mean, is this a center of jazz, North Carolina?
Pretty much. It's the center now. Something in the water here, I think. Well, a lot of artists have traveled through North or South Carolina. I mean, Dizzy Gillespie's from Churaw, South Carolina, so there's artists down there as well. But some of them were either born here and lived here for a short time, and actually that's kind of the case, or they were born elsewhere and moved here and lived here for a time, and, you know, anywhere where there's, you know, someone's lived where they go off and become famous, we always want to claim them as our mm-hmm. own. So Thelonious Monk's from Rocky Mount. John Coltrane was born in Hamlet and lived there for just, you know, a few months of his life, and then grew up in High Point. You've got even Nina Simone, who's from here as well. You've got Billy Strayhorn, who's from Ohio, but then due to his father being a drunkard, so the story goes, his mother sent him to live with the grandparents in Hillsboro for some time, and so he spent some years here as well.
If you drive on Churton Street in Hillsboro, you can see the
right.
sign to Billy Strayhorn there.
Yeah.
So do you think that, again, people leave North Carolina, right? We don't hear about the Cotton Club in
some
North Carolina.
Leave.
Some people leave, and then some people come here and talk about them. But do you think there's anything to be said for the Southern connection to jazz, that you can still hear, you know, these people, if they were raised and they're listening to the music that they're surrounded by, say, in the 1920s and the 1930s and 1940s when these folks are growing up. Is there some connection there between
Absolutely.
The Southern? What are some of those elements?
Well, I think it's the whole African-American element and just traditions that have been passed down throughout the South, including North Carolina. And those roots are deep, and that's some of the things I think we'll talk about. And it's, you know, it's easier to demonstrate, to show some slides and then listen to audio and then demonstrate what's going on in the music, and you can begin. And also we have some videos that you can see those connections that, you know, just those roots. I think a lot of times we talk about race on a very surface level, but we forget deep family roots and talents and traditions that have been passed down for generations. And I think that's what it is.
What was it that got you personally into jazz piano in the first place? How do you go from being a pianist to being a jazz pianist specifically?
Well, my mom was a neighborhood pianist when we were little, a neighborhood piano teacher, I should say. And she forced all five of us to play piano, and then it didn't really stick. I didn't start until high school, and then I was not a good person in high school. And then I got serious about it in college.
Few of us were.
Yeah, I got serious about it in college, and that's when it just, I really felt that that was like, that was me.
What is it about jazz that speaks to you?
Well, it's, there's a lot of things, but what helped me realize that that would be an art form that I could really have a voice in is just the improvisational element to it, you know, that you don't have to play black dots on the page exactly verbatim. You know, classical pianists will always talk about the freedom within the notation, but but not like us.
Yeah, exactly.
Not the same kind of thing.
Now, speaking with Steve Anderson and, of course, Max Ornstein and Brian Horton are going to be talking and playing, right, at Flyleaf Books on May 22nd, which is 2 weeks from this Wednesday at Flyleaf from 5:30 to 7, humanities.unc.edu. Is the website. So we're talking about some of the legend. You mentioned Coltrane, you mentioned Thelonious Monk, Billy Strayhorn. What is it about their, what is it about them that makes them legendary?
Well, I think, you know, if you're going to go into music, and I mean this in the most positive way, you have to be crazy. I mean, you really do. It's not an easy field to make a living in, and you have to just be extremely passionate, and you have to live it day and night. I mean, I know in my case, I wake up at 4 in the morning all the time, but not by choice, but I just wake up, and then so I start working, and then, you know, keep working all day. And that's how those guys were. They were just, Coltrane was known to just incessantly be practicing, like in between sets, you know, he'd be in the back practicing, and that's why he just created this formidable technique that no one had. You know, the critic, Ira Glitler, you know, coined the term sheets of sound because he just could play so many notes so fast like any other person before him, you know, that just be due to that passion for practicing.
What's interesting about Monk and Coltrane in particular is that not only are they sort of giants of jazz, but they're really revolutionary in terms of their sound. You were mentioning, of course, Coltrane with his practicing methods, but of course his incorporation of things like these incredible scales and the giant steps and Slonimsky methods that he's putting in there, all of those. And of course, Monk's very particular. You can hear Monk 1 second and the notes that he's playing and sort of odd colorings that he puts on normal chords and what you might think of as a sort of standard jazz format, but it just sounds distinctly Monk. I want to just pretend that that's the Tar Heel influence on the two of them, but could you speak to how the two of them, or maybe Monk in particular, because you're a pianist, what Monk did to the piano and why his playing is so distinctive and considered revolutionary?
Yeah, Monk is kind of divisive among pianists. Like, all the jazz pianists love him. I've heard classical pianists say, oh, I can't listen to him. He had extremely unorthodox technique. He played with stretched out fingers, which you're not supposed to do. You're supposed to have your hand in nice curved fingers and cupping shape. And you know, we all learn that way, but he had very straight, long fingers, and he'd play in a very quirky, off-the-key style. What I love about Monk is that, and this is my personal feeling, is just like when he plays so offbeat, it's in between the normal syncopations. He plays in the cracks of the rhythms. And actually, that's had a profound impact on me. In my feeling, I don't know if Marcus Roberts would claim this, but I was highly influenced by the blind pianist Marcus Roberts, who played with Wynton Marsalis for a long time. And I hear that in his playing, that he would comp the rhythms, you know, behind the soloists in the cracks. And to me, I think it's an outgrowth of Monk, just that, you know, and Monk would just do crazy things that no one else would think to do. He'd have these chord progressions that would just loop back and forth over and over, you know, in a way that no one else would think of. But in an odd way, when you stop and reflect, it's like, oh, that makes sense in a very unorthodox way.
So I always thank my father for putting Monk on. When I hear a song like Straight No Chaser, to me it sounds just normal because I grew up with it. But sometimes people hear that and says that sounds really close to sort of a normal blues song, but there's something that Monk is doing to Straight No Chaser that makes it, you know, odd and distinct. It seems natural to my ear because I grew up with it. You know, and Coltrane's really interesting, too, when Coltrane goes through these various phases of sort of this hard bop phase into his modal phase.
Exactly.
And so what was that growth like? And will you be exploring that a little bit in your talk?
Yeah, well, I need to talk to Brian Horton and see what he wants to talk about as well. I know if I were the only one speaking, I have things that I always teach. And exactly what you said, I'm always impressed with how much you know about jazz.
Well, like I said,
I'm
Jim
just
Moore.
Really glad that the two of you know so much about jazz, because that's like a block in my knowledge base. Yeah.
No. All right. What was the question again?
His phases.
Yeah. So early on, you know, in his early years, like a lot of young players, he's just forming his technique. He's practicing ferociously. He actually played alto for a while, and he was in the Navy for about a year. And then he played in Dizzy Gillespie's band, I think it was like 1949 off the top of my head, on alto. And then he switches to tenor. And that's when he starts to get his big sound. And what's interesting when he plays with Miles on that classic kind of blue album is that all those artists were playing, they were soloing in a very different way. Mm-hmm. I believe that that's where Coltrane would have first been exposed to modality, which basically means stripping out all the extra chords. You have to know that the generation before Miles was all about fast, quick chord changes, and they would arpeggiate notes over those chords, and that's how they got a formidable techniques, you know, that sound. Miles would say, the music has gotten really thick. I can't play that way, you know, and he was more about melody and openness. So on that album, they do this tune, So What, that only has two chords to it. And the legend is that, you know, Miles would, you know, sketch out chord changes on a matchbook and didn't tell them beforehand what they would play because he wanted that spontaneity. He didn't want them practicing and knowing what they were going to do. So Miles was always, he was in a few different phases during those years. He was both a hard bop artist, as we call him, and also a cool artist, which was very relaxed and trying not to be, you know, confrontational or aggressive rhythmically. He was consciously avoiding that in that music, and Coltrane was on that session. But what Coltrane began to discover, you know, when he was the leader during those years, he was doing the hard bop, you know, talking about very aggressive, quick chord changes. But then his tune Impressions is really interesting because he takes the exact same chord progression, which we call a contrafact, when you take someone else's chord progression but write a new melody.
Sure.
And he did that, but he did it in his own way. Instead of being relaxed and cool like Miles was, he was strong and aggressive. And long and short of it, in his second phase, which is really my favorite phase of Coltrane's music, he had been searching for different rhythm section players, and he finally got the perfect combination,
yeah,
the classic
Elvin
Coltrane
Jones.
Chord. Yeah, Elvin and...
Ron Carter
was in Miles.
Oh, Garrison.
Jimmy Garrison. And the guy I named my son after.
Aaron's rolling his eyes.
This is all brand new information.
McCoy Chyner.
This is great, yeah.
And
yeah,
it was just the perfect combination of players. And so Coltrane starts exploring that openness that Miles had of stripping away the extra chords. In fact, the My Favorite Things album they did in 61, that originally had a lot of chords, but they treated it modally to strip out a lot of extra chords, though it has this open sound that sounds like it doesn't need to resolve. But the difference between Coltrane and Miles was the Coltrane Quartet was always about power. It's kind of like heavy metal in the 80s. You know, they discovered distortion.
Well, college males like Coltrane in this era.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's when I fell in love with
really?
It.
Really?
Yeah, absolutely.
So, you know, in other words, he had that same chord progression that, you know, with the So What progression that Miles had, but instead of being relaxed and open, it was more just strong and powerful.
Yeah.
And that's kind of the direction he went in. Increasingly, through the end of his life, when he gets into his third phase, which is the avant-garde phase.
Sure.
Yeah.
We've got to start wrapping up. But again, this is going to be 2 weeks from Wednesday, May 22nd is the day, 5:30 to 7 p.m. at Flyleaf Giants of North Carolina Jazz. Steve Anderson, you're hearing him. Brian Horton will also be there. Humanities.unc.edu is the website for more information. And then it's all part of the Flyleaf Summer Series Wednesday's event, which is all music-based.
This will be the first of them, and we're doing bluegrass after. We're going to have a really similar kind of discussion about bluegrass and playing playing, a little secret is I'll be playing guitar with the bluegrass band on that one. So they let me, it saves us money. And then we'll be doing slave narratives in prose and in singing. And then finally, we'll have demonstrations of the physics of music with Laurie McNeil.
Awesome.
So really, again, all of them will have demonstration and performance as well as discussion. So
humanities.unc.edu for more information on all of those and more. Max Orr, Steve Anderson, thank you so much for being
with
us
today. Thank you so much, Aaron.